Hello, Radioland. You are listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores. This is another episode of Darshiv. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett, and this is the radio program where we talk about archives and special collections. We talk about folks who work in the information world and those who are generally curious. Today is a bit of a part two, if you will, to a research episode that we did at the beginning of last year. It is episode number 50. If you want to go back and check it out, we used the alternative press to investigate the topic around how the new left and the counterculture picked up on J.R.R. Tolkien's fantasy world of Middle Earth. And this is kind of the part two where we bring in an expert in the field to flesh out their perspectives on the topic. If you want to get ahead before any spoilers maybe potentially arise, please go back and check out that episode if you would like to. I naturally was excited to stumble upon Assistant Professor Dexter Gabriel from the UConn History Department, who teaches the Black Atlantic, slavery, abolition, and emancipation, who has a most excellent Twitter handle, which is the Disgruntled Herodrum. And this hits a bit of a sweet spot in terms of thinking critically about the world of fantasy, its cultural impact, and the characters that can kind of inhabit the fantastical. For those who have no idea what Disgruntled Herodrum means, I'm going to ask him to kind of unpack it for us. But he writes speculative fiction under the pen name Fenderson Jelly Clark. He has won many awards, including The Nebula. Dexter, welcome to Darshiv.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Maybe just for some context, can you unpack for the listeners what this persona of the Disgruntled Herodrum is all
about? Disgruntled Herodrum or Disgruntled Herodrum, depends on which Tolkienist you're listening to and how to pronounce it. But in Tolkien's world, people familiar with Middle Earth, because everybody saw the Peter Jackson movies at least, if they didn't read the books. Far-Harad are the people to the south, just like there are people to the east, Easterlings, as the name goes. And these folks were basically described often as being swarthy or dark-skinned. So if you're wondering where all the swarthier and darker-skinned people were in Peter Jackson's version of Tolkien's world, that's where they lived. And generally, for a host of reasons, not getting the proper wizard education, you could say, or guidance, these people all fell under the sway of the bad guys. And so they were generally described as, you know, antisocial, on the wrong side of that spat over mystical jewelry, two spats over mystical jewelry, and were friends of Sauron. And you may have seen them in the Peter Jackson movies, riding the elephants and what have you. And so I created a blog a while back called Disgruntled Herodrum, where I basically, my point was, hey, what's it like to be the bad guys in Tolkien's world, the swarthier, dark-skinned Eastern and people from the South. What's it like being one of those folks, but like in Tolkien anyway? And it became a blog that I used to talk about speculative fiction, but as well as diversity and issues of race in speculative fiction.
That's awesome. Thanks so much for unpacking that. I feel like there's, you know, there's layers to this, right?
Oh,
like,
so many.
How do you not alienate the general person? Yeah. This is so where the digging needs to happen into that world, right? He provides us with the prompt that there is a world that exists that looks like this, but I'm not going to tell you anything about it, right? Like, let's just leave that to the bad side and hope that you can flesh it out with what, fan fiction? Which is a question I'll have for you a little later. So as a historian, of course, in our history department, you have a background in research, of course, to get to the place that you are, publishing intellectual work as well as fiction. Can you talk a little bit about how sort of the very real lived past has influenced your creative writing, if at all?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. So, you know, I think it has a lot to do with the type of creative speculative fiction that I was into. I owe my love of speculative fiction to a lot of things, including my parents. My father was a big Godzilla fan, like the old rubbery Godzilla, not these new like super CGI Godzilla with the old rubber suit ones. My mother was much more into Star Trek and Twilight Zone. And so those old black and white Twilight Zones. And they were very didactic. People have seen them. They have all these meanings. They come up during the Cold War. So there are whole episodes just about Cold War or, you know, the Red Scare or what have you. And so I was, I guess for a long time, I was really interested in speculative fiction that had this larger meaning, that had these more overt political meanings. And I discovered Ray Bradbury when I was in middle school, then Frank Herbert. And so, you know, I always had this idea of politics and commentary within speculative fiction. That was the stuff that I was really into. And so I think when I started writing my earliest speculative fiction writings, none of these have been published, by the way, nobody's seen it. They were very didactic and they tended to pull from aspects of history or politics or social commentary. And I think that's kind of continued. And even if there isn't commentary, like at least overtly, I actually teach a workshop called History and World Building, because one of my arguments is that all speculative fiction pulls from history because we only have one history. So whether you're doing the far-flung future with Frank Herbert or you're doing George R. Martin's nebulous secondary past, you are pulling on some aspect of our history to tell that story. And so not surprising, history has influenced my writing. Yeah.
Very cool. Have you seen archives as providing any kind of value for that concept, using archives for your own personal research, yeah, for either?
You know, it's funny. Some of the stories that I've written have actually come from me not looking for these things. I didn't go into the archives, oh, I want to find this one thing for speculative fiction, but I stumble upon it in the archives. And sometimes it's not even the stuff I'm looking for, but I'll see it and I'll set it aside. Like, you know, I have a novella called Ring Shout, where the Klan are monsters. And where I got that from was in the archives of narratives from ex-slaves. And I came across that a long time before I wrote that story. But I saw that and I said, well, this is fascinating. And I put it to the side. Right. And so stuff like that happens where some aspect of history, or I have a short story, The Secret Lies of the Nine Negro Teeth of George Washington. And that comes from the Washington, the archives actually at Mount Vernon at Washington's old home, and where they talk about, you know, it was found in the archives that in his possession were nine teeth of likely enslaved people that he owned, whether or not he put them in his own dentures. Everybody knows his famous problems with teeth, or used them. We don't know. But those were ways that some aspect of history, I saw it. I didn't immediately jump and write a story. I didn't go looking for it. But when it came time to tell the story, it was there for me.
That is so cool. Also, Ring Shout has gotten rave reviews. It's made lists. It's been shortlisted for awards and won them. Really awesome book.
Thank you.
So you'd mentioned a little bit about, you know, maybe politics is always within your work. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to tease this out as far as Tolkien is concerned, because he sort of constantly insisted that his work was not an analogy
yeah,
for anything of any historical event that he either witnessed directly during World War I, in which he's like in the trenches writing these books, or with the encroaching industrialization in his own backyard, sort of like the last green that he's seeing, or even from afar with the rise of Nazism in World War II, like very much feels like the wheelhouse where those, where Lord of the Rings was written. However, he sort of denies that this is the case. How do you think about analogy when setting the table, I guess, for your characters?
Yeah. I have no idea why Tolkien says those things, because Tolkien scholars will go like, okay, ants are not the meanings of, you know, the orcs being the tools of industrialization versus the ecological ants. The dead marchers have nothing to do with the dead you would have seen on the field in the mud-strewn fields of World War One. I have no idea why Tolkien says these things when it's more than obvious. As a linguist who's actually going through and pulling from aspects of history, I have no idea. But I will say that, you know, I always say this, like everything that we do as writers or saying speculative, just with speculative fiction is somehow political, right? Some of it is more political and some of it is less political. Like Frank Herbert, very much talking about resource wars, issues of the Middle East, and other ideas of politics and religion that he sees, very overt. Star Trek, very overtly talking about things of politics, right? Star Wars as well, even if people missed it. Yeah, it's about space Nazis and the rise of fascism and how that happens very much as well. And so, you know, I think that politics and commentary color all of our writings, but it can be more than others. Like I have some story, I have a novella out now called The Dead Cattail Assassins. And this is one story, however, which is not very political. I'm not trying to give a great deal of commentary in it, but do aspects of my political thinking and ideologies end up in it? Sure they do. The bad folks are rich and powerful. Oh, wow, that's surprising, right? And there are other things I do in there and bring in certain cultural elements that I felt I didn't see in fantasy a lot. And so to me, that work is probably on the spectrum of how things can be political on a low end, whereas Ring Shout, I would put it much more on a high end. But I think that you can go into any work and find it there, no matter what you're reading, what you're doing. I just don't buy that there's a neutral work, because even how other people read your work and perceive it can be political in its own way.
Right. And that's something that we explored for sure with the Tolkien and the sort of new left counterculture taking his classic masterpiece, this 3-volume work of The Lord of the Rings, and seeing this as an analogy for anti-war movement, for ecology, etc. And yet he's like disavowing all of these people. Like he refers to him as his cultists, you know, like the campus cult concept is very much who is picking up this book. Mm-hmm. And I guess from that artist's perspective, you know, does that trouble you at all? Like, does that get in the way sometimes of you thinking about, oh, who's actually going to receive this? Or even from like the editor and your publisher, you know, do you think about that sort of, oh, I'm not sure how this is going to be received compared to my other work. I've set this tone already about like, this is how I write and build my characters.
Yeah, I mean, you're always thinking about your audience as you're writing. I think you have to. But there's a difference between being aware and empathetic to that and letting it, I suppose, overtake your writing, right? At the end of the day, I always say, I'm going to write what I want. Because I have had people who were like, oh, I was thinking this one because I like when he does alternative history. And I was hoping this was more of that. And I'm like, okay, you might get some of that later, but I'm going to write what I want to write. Right. So, certainly it comes to my mind. And so I'm always aware of what I'm writing. I would say words are powerful, so be aware of what you're doing. And so I'm aware of it. And I realize people may have different viewpoints. They may have certain things they like. And I'm like, that's fine. Maybe this isn't for you. Maybe you're just a Ring Shout person, or people who Ring Shout's too political. Okay, here you go. I'm going to give you everything you want. Right. You take your pick.
I'm about halfway through a Benny song right now. Yeah. And it's great. It kind of reminds me a lot of maybe the elements of like Roots, where there is like this storytelling narrative kind of like carrying through, and where is the original place kind of where these ideas come from. Can you talk a little bit about what that sort of African diaspora storytelling narrative, how that has impacted the way that you write creative fiction?
So Benny's song was like my foray into middle grade, which is a whole different world. You try writing for middle graders, it's a very different world than writing for adults. And, you know, it came out of my own childhood. I tried to remember back when was the time that I enjoyed reading the most. And it was, you know, when I was younger, when I was reading, like, you know, when I was 7 to 12 or so, and I was reading Tolkien, and I was reading The Mouse and the Motorcycle, and I was reading Ursula Le Guin, you know, and I couldn't go to bed because I needed to keep the light on with a flashlight and get through these pages. It was like, it was the most intense for me. And so there was... So I wanted to capture that again in the writing. And so a lot of that is bringing the influence of that, is bringing in the influence of things I watched. I grew up, while I was of age, you know, watching like Neverending Story and Legend and Willow and those kinds of things were like what I watched, and The Dark Crystal. And so huge influence. I love Spirited Away. And that when I say it, people who read the book go, oh, I see that. I can see the idea of the kid who meets the spirits. And so it had a lot of influences. But I think getting at what you're asking, one of the things that, you know, while I loved growing up with all of that was, of course, the lack of representation in a lot of those books. Even if Ursula Le Guin had characters that were black and brown, the cover was whitewashed. So I never knew if somebody was trolling me or gaslighting me. I read one thing and I see a different cover. And you just didn't see a lot of people of color, unless, you know, unfortunately, like in Tolkien's world, they were on the bad side of things. And so I wanted to write a book where I can bring that in, but even more than simply physical representation, I wanted cultural representation. So I wanted to bring in a different setting for a fantasy world, right? Rather than the elf, dwarf, and a ranger meet in a tavern that looks like it's from London, I want to have a Western Central African experience. And then I also want to bring in an African diaspora experience. So there's some aspects of African-American Southern folklore in that story, even though it has a very West African setting. There are aspects of Afro-Caribbean folklore. And really, a lot of that was me pulling from much of that, many of these storytellers, many of these tales, getting a chance to bring them to the fore, using some of those narrative techniques of the way oral stories flow and the way they're captured. In fact, oral storytelling is a big part of the plot of this. It's literally what a Benny song is. It's this oral tale. And so, yeah, certainly that went into it. But at the end of the day, I'm also a product of the West. I live here. And so, you know, I always say I'm as influenced by African oral storytelling as I am by Charles Dickens and Tolkien, right? All of and Ursula Le Guin, all of that went into making it. Yeah.
And isn't that really the kernel of all of this, that these overlaps that you can draw from to mm-hmm. build like such a layered work feels far more compelling than,
yeah.
I mean, yes, the classics of something like The Lord of the Rings is, it's just like so entirely a pocket of Northwest England or something
yeah.
with no, the romance is that.
Yeah.
The opposite is the Haradrim, right?
Like, right, right.
The stark black and white of it, but bringing in these elements, and I feel like Frank Herbert does this pretty yeah. well too, where he's drawing from languages from all over the world
yeah.
that actually exist, influencing how a culture can be like one thing, but also like another, and that is just so much more compelling.
Yeah, I think so, and I'll even push back and say, I'll even say that's part of Tolkien. I think that there is the perception of this, I suppose, concealed Northwestern European ideology that he's pulling on. But I think that Smaug shares many Eastern aspects, for instance, of a dragon than certain Western European aspects, right? And so you always think about Tolkien, a person who grew up in the British Empire, where there are cultural aspects coming in and out, right? So it's this thing, like when you start, like, I just wonder how much, if you really delve into the thing, certainly, yes, he's pulling, he is a linguist, he's pulling from a lot of Nordic tales and all these European tales. But, you know, I mean, England is the influence of Southern Europe, Rome on England and so forth, right? So there's this, there are all these long histories. And I think of somebody like George R. R. Martin, right? So I was in Italy just this summer, and being there, I was like, oh, I'm in Old Valeria. I'm literally at the ruins of Old Valeria in Rome, right? And I think about how he creates his world, like where Westeros is very England, but here is someplace that is completely different in his world, right? He recognizes that being in Southern Europe is certainly not being in England, and that this is a different cultural world entirely, that in some ways at times is more rooted to this Eastern world than it is perhaps to this Westeros world, right? And the way he bridges that. And so, you know, I think Tolkien does it less, but I think he tries to create this notion of there's this encapsulated, walled-off region, but I question how much that is, personally, even looking at medieval stories, because even in the medieval era, how much medieval European stories are also being shared, being basically taken from the Eastern world as well, right? And how much of that being cross-shared. So anyway, that's my long-winded bit, but yeah.
That's a very maybe important
yeah.
way to look at, I mean, Tolkien born in South Africa, what influences maybe where he is from mm-hmm. is coming through in ways that we haven't quite digested. Of course, South Asia, the subcontinent, part yeah. of the British Empire, what is actually coming in?
Mm-hmm. It's more than just tea.
I was going to say, like, where is Bilbo getting his tea from? Have we sourced that yet in the work? Well, to stem maybe from Tolkien work specifically and thinking about maybe the potential or the creative aspects that we can draw from, in the previous episode, we explored the fanzines, kind of the world of people taking on popular narratives and making them their own. You know, have you ever considered, I guess, working within Tolkien's world of Middle-earth with this disgruntled Haradrim idea? Not to say you aren't maybe doing that in your own work, but is this something that you've considered?
You know, I don't know if I have consciously that way. I think sometimes I'm both doing odes to Tolkien, but answering him back in my own way in some of the stories I write, even in a Benny song. There's definitely some Tolkienist ideas in there, and then there's some pushback against Tolkien in there, right? Because I always say we all have these, if you're a fantasy writer, you all have these old foundational grandpas who are like anybody's grandpas. You're like, okay, well, that's interesting. I don't like that other stuff. And so you're trying to work with what you got, right? And so there's praise and there's criticism at the same time. And so you're doing odes to him and pushing back against it in my work. So definitely there, but I haven't thought of going into his work. People have done great works. But you see, I mean, if anybody's watching Rings of Power now, I think Rings of Power is definitely doing that. Rings of Power is showing that you can have a Tolkien multiverse, as you know, Peter Jackson, and even though people are like Peter Jackson was authentic to the original, no, he wasn't. Anybody who's read his works, you know that there are people pointing out all the different things he did and changed. I think just that I've noticed the Rings of Power, as far as diversity, is showing everything out there. Really, as far as even questioning, like, are the orcs essentially evil, or is there more? They're asking these questions that people have been asking more and more about fantasy. Whether they'll execute it right, I don't know. Well, that has to be seen. That's up to a creative license. But it's interesting that they're going there in ways, right? They are pushing back against essentialist narratives of good, evil, and forcing us to question things, I think, more than Tolkien did. And they're opening up his world, which is what I just want to say, which is what should be done. Like, people have this notion that, well, the work was done and it has to stay exactly this way. That work spoke for when it did. As much as I loved reading all the works of Tolkien, I said, you could not have one for one translated The Lord of the Rings into a film. Because for one, there'd be no action scenes. It would just be Aragorn slew many orcs.
And singing.
and lots of singing, right? That works, you know, in reading form, works during a certain era. That was not going to work in the 1990s and early 21st century when they were making films. It had to adapt to the medium. It had to adapt to the time. And I always say the best works have the ability to do that, whether the author wanted them to or not. They have that elasticity so that you can bring them into this era and you can do something different with them. Is the execution always right? No, that's a creative issue. But the work opens itself up and allows that. And I hope that, you know, my work, I'm so lucky that, you know, 30, 40 years later, somebody wants to do something with it and wants to take it to another level.
Wouldn't that be awesome? Someone's been inspired enough by the things that you have created instead of, you know, how he's kind of, at least what we ended up seeing through his letters that were published about how, like, curmudgeon-y he kind of gets about the control. And then there was some quote where he was like, as protective of my work as I am, I still am deeply invested in its futures.
Right.
And I want to kind of see how that's
going to play out. For its futures, you have to allow other people to play in that world. Yeah, and you have to allow them to interpret it based on things that you could not have possibly thought of when you were writing it. Yeah.
And maybe just as the preface for your maybe future work in Middle Earth, you did paraphrase this at the beginning, but I'm going to directly quote it from your website. In the beginning, there was Eru Iluvatar, who brought the Ainur into being and threw their song all into existence. Somehow, millennia later, I, along with much of the swarthier side of Arda, ended up on the wrong side of a spat about mystical jewelry. Disgruntled about the whole affair, I decided to start penning my own stories that perhaps could tell new, diverse tales from differing perspectives.
Yeah.
That's the foreword right there to the
blog, yeah. Yeah.
But you're doing it now, man, and you're doing it on, like, a publisher's level. So can you talk us through a little bit about how did you view what you were going to create at the beginning? Were you like, I need a published book, and it needs to be read in an airport book store or...
Oh, the airport bookstore. That's like the holy grail of yes. authors, right? I still check airports. I'm just like, is my book in here? And I've only found it a few times, and it's amazing. It's an amazing feeling.
Totally. That's a big deal.
And by
deal.
The way, it's a lot of that is, I hate to break people's bubble, it's such payola. It's such like, you have to have like the right marketing people that said, hey, let's put these books in here. It's not, there's a lot of authors who will not find their books in there. Unless some indie stores is what you're looking for who... Well, studio stuff. But no, I mean, you know, my writing journey was odd. I never took a creative writing class, never got an MFA. My writing, I would say like, Lisa, where'd you learn the art of writing? Reading? It's my answer. People would be like, oh, I see you did a 3-part story structure. I did a 3-part what? Right? I'm like the guy who's never studied music, but just knows it. But if you ask him to sit down and do the notes, he's like, what's this? Right? And so I had to go back and learn after I'd started publishing, like, oh, this is what I've been doing. I've been following along. It's like, I just know when the beat should stop or so forth. And so my writing journey was of someone who wanted to tell stories. And I won't lie, there was a great drive to tell, like I said, these new diverse stories. Because I've read all these works. I've read all my Robert Jordan. You know, I've read Wheel of Time like so many times. I've read all these things. And my thing is, I want to see different people in here. I want to see stories from different places and different cultures, right? I want to write different type of stories. Like I wrote a short story of a young black boy who's in the court of Peter the Great, and it's supposed to be Alexander Pushkin's grandfather, right, who was himself an enslaved person who ends up in the Russian court, right? And I was like, what's that like, right? And then Pushkin ends up becoming, you know, the greatest Russian writer, this mixed-race man. So I was like, I want to, like, pull from history in this way. And then I turned it into fantasy. So there's magic, and there's you know, Eastern Slavic folk tales and everything. And I said, yeah, I want to do that kind of fantasy, right? Like, there's a story, a young black boy in the middle of, you know, 17th century Russia. How is this not a story? like this is a story. And so who ends up in the court, and he ends up being adopted. He's enslaved, but he ends up practically being adopted by Peter the Great, and his godmother is the Queen of Poland. And this is, and his, later on, his grandson will become Russia's most famous writer. And this isn't a fantasy story? How? And so, you know, I've set about wanting to do that. Wasn't easy. No, I knew nothing about the publishing world. And so, yeah, I said, I want to publish a book. I want to publish lots of books. 12 years later, so I finally got my break after a lot of attempts. But yeah, that was I went into it with a lot of that passion and naivete, being naive, really, about how it would be done. And it worked out how it worked out.
Is there any publishing circuitous nugget that you want to share with listeners? You know, we talked about Tolkien's Ace paperback drama, that somebody's pirate printing something. It leads to it getting popular in the United States. Anything that you found in that sort of translation between the writing to the market?
So I will say this. When my big break from writing came with a complete fluke, I had written a novelette called Dead Jinn in Cairo, which would go on to be the head of the Dead Jinn in Cairo series that, you know, now has novellas and a novel. And when I wrote that, there was no ways to publish it, because anybody knew how short story publishing worked. If you had a novella or a novelette, you might as well hold on to it, because most of the e-zines were like 6,000 words, you know, 7,000 is it. You can't go any further. And so I wrote this story at 12,000+. I was always an overwriter. I didn't know what to do with it. Sometimes I would try to chop it down, but I was like, if I chop this, it won't make sense. It'll look choppy. And so I was going to do what I tended to do, retire it to the abyss, where it was just no one was ever going to see it. And then I decided instead to put out, this was 2015, to put out something on Facebook and basically saying, hey, I have this long novelette, alternate steampunk Cairo with magic and gin and a lady detective who wears suits in it. Does anybody know where I can get this published? I got a few hits. They said, oh, there's this one place that publishes like longer form. Here's another. And an editor at Tor, Diana Foe, who ran a blog called Beyond Victoriana, and actually knew her that way because she had cross-posted some of my blog. But it didn't click with me that she was an editor at Tor. And so she was like, oh, send me the story. And I was like, why do you want the story? You want to publish it on your blog? That's not what I'm looking for. And then I happened to notice, like, at the bottom of her thing was like tour editor. And I was like, not the tour, anybody who reads fantasy, the people on the back of all my books. And so I was like, sure, send your story. And then I forgot about it, which is what you should do when you send stuff off. And like 3 or 4 months later, she gets back to me and says, hey, I want to publish this. I've been looking for a steampunk story, a diverse steampunk story for Tor's main website. I want to publish this. And that gave me my break, right? And so I would say that that was such a fluke, right? Like if I hadn't sent that out, she hadn't been watching, it wouldn't have happened. Like I always say, it's like Zefrin Cochran flying out when the Vulcan survey ship happens to come out. We both happen to meet at the same time, right? And that literally launched my publishing. I'd published a few short stories in some semi-pro markets, but that really launched my, I can get book deals now. And that did it. And it was just, so I always say my thing there, if I always tell people, the moral of that lesson is shoot your shot at any time, because you never know who's watching.
And is that kind of how the publishing industry works? You get that one in and it's kind of like, here it is.
You hope, right? I mean, that's what I'd wanted to do for so long. The publishing world, when I first came to it, was like this walled fortress that you knew that there are these people called editors and there are people called agents, especially. It's like the Matrix, right? They're agents and they hold the doors, they hold the keys to all the doors. And like your thing was trying to get an agent, trying to get in, but it often felt like, especially if you were a person of color, like where I was on online spaces where there were Black creatives doing speculative fiction, they were like in another world from the publishing. A lot of them were doing indie publishing because they felt they could not get through that fortress. And so getting your foot in the door was a thing you were always wanting to do, right? Like, and you would hope it would, like, maybe I'll be writing at a coffee shop and someone would just come along, or, you know, you hope that it just happens by chance. Because the other way is the grueling, let me get my stuff right, let me send out stuff, to query letters to agents, and let me see what I can do. Now, I think social media, a little bit around the time I was doing this, social media was bringing down some of those doors, because you would have agents and doing things like PitMad, for instance, where it was like, oh, you know, basically give me your pitch for your novel, and if I like it, I might ask for more. And it was a good equalizing space in social media, and right, it's not surprising that social media helped me get my break. Now, for much of the publishing world, it's still the old way. It's still querying an agent, hoping you get in. But it's probably, I won't say it's fully democratized, but it's those walls have come down a bit, though there's still work to do, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So being an academic scholar, which you go by your real name.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have a handle, of course, as a creative writer, P. Jelly Clark. Tolkien is not dissimilar in the place that he comes from in academia, and yeah, then as a side thing, starts to do a little writing.
Right.
And both of those, of course, rise to notice. In terms of how you have thought about when you put on that hat as P. Jelly Clark, is there much talk in the classroom about ways to explore historical topics, or ways that you would maybe accept a paper that maybe still has citations but has some creative aspect to it? Does any of that bleed over?
No, for the most part. It hasn't yet. And I'll say the most I've done is, you know, I may show a clip from a film or something, or talk or bring up something speculative in the classroom, but it hasn't. And I mean, part of that is just the way that, especially in history, how history's been taught, how history should be written. And so I haven't bridged those two. You know, I will use some literary stuff. Like I've taught courses before where I've used Art Spiegelman's Mouse, for instance. So I like using graphic novels if I can. I've used Persepolis and these other things in the classroom. But I haven't done the full bridge where the classes I teach, where I can bring over that speculative side. But I've been wondering how. Like I teach a lot of courses on slavery and emancipation. I just read Jesmyn Ward's Let Us Descend, for instance. And I think something like that would be a good bridge. Or Toni Morrison's Beloved. I think there are ways you can have that bridge, but I simply haven't come up with it yet. Outside of the graphic novel, I have used a graphic novel on Nat Turner and others, those, but I haven't fully done the speculative side. That's something to still conquer. Yeah.
Right. I don't want to put your work into a bucket, and I'm sure you don't either necessarily, yeah, but I did want to talk a little bit about how you see your work or how you describe it. But I want to preface this first with kind of an idea about what the possibilities are, maybe within those genres or outside those genres that you work in. So regarding the nature of your work and how you view, you know, again, this politics as an author. So opposite from the 1960s New Left, there has been sort of a recent claim on Tolkien's work by sort of alt-right.
Dun, 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 dun.
So people like J.D. Vance, a lot of folks now apparently who are both Catholic and conservative are looking to Tolkien and saying, this is the world that I am making or that I am heavily influenced by Tolkien's work. We've talked on this podcast before in previous episodes about sort of the Victorian period when the tastes of, say, Sir Walter Scott's books become like a real star, so to speak, for the post-Reconstruction South that kind of adopt some of these tropes that trafficked in that romance of the planter class, maybe as a knight. And I feel like Ring Shout has a lot of commentary on those kinds of ideas, like who kind of dresses themselves up in a certain way. And I'm wondering what you think about fantasy and Afrofuturism, or however you want to kind of generally describe the bucket that you think your work lives in. How do you feel it being thrust into these camps, and how does it impact the way that you sort of approach the writing itself, knowing that there are those folks out there who are going to say, this is my world, or this is definitely not my world?
Yeah, I mean, they're always going to be that, right? And that's like how alt-right folks did. I always call them geeks gone bad. I mean, you know, but I mean, a lot of them to me don't even understand the work. Like the guys who will watch, for instance, Du Bois, and they'll dress as like Homelander. And it's like, he's not a good guy. The fact that you can't get this, you're a terrible geek. Like, you're bad at this. Like, how did you come out thinking that? It's like, and I've seen it. Like, I saw some right wing ad say, we're going to create a Death Star. Okay, space Nazi. If you want to, but those aren't the good guys. And so, you know, it's like the old joke with the guy in the Nazi uniform. It's like, are we the baddies? It's like, I think some people don't fully understand it. I mean, even, you know, I said, if they could co-opt the Matrix into a red pill, the blue pill thing, when the Matrix is the most wildly, talk about leftist counterculture. I mean, Rage Against the Machine is the soundtrack. I mean, it lends itself to people who might simply be trying to buy into an anti-establishment ideology where you can see where it can lead down right-wing rabbit holes and so forth. But it comes at the cost of ignoring so many things. Even as Tolkien, this is not new, right? Nazi Germany found some love in The Hobbit and some of his works, to which Tolkien reputedly, you know, is like, nope, not my bag at all, right? And so I think, you know, people will try to latch on to these things. And I think, you know, as people in the culture, it's just a matter for us to stand up and say, you know, nope. Like, if you, that's fine if you want to interpret it that way, but many of us do not. And even if that's where it was, we're going to take it somewhere else. Like Lovecraft, right? If they want to claim somebody, they can certainly claim Lovecraft. He's right in that wheelhouse, right? His stuff is definitively, Lovecraft is no bones about it. This was not even a Tolkien level or Bradbury, some cringy things. This was Lovecraft was full on white supremacist, anti-Semitic ideologies. This is the basis of his work. But many people have gone in there and done completely different things with it. Look what Ruff did with Lovecraft Country. And then HBO took it even further, right? Jordan Peele's company took it even further there. And so, and you know, you can be influenced by some of the worst. Like I always say, we all like tentacles. We just don't like Lovecraft's tentacles, right? So we're going to do our own thing with it, and we're going to turn it around, right? We're going to make the monsters, you know, the heroes aren't going to be the white supremacy like Lovecraft would have liked. That's going to be the enemy, right? So I think you can do that. As far as the larger question of, I guess you could say, how to classify the stuff I do, I just use the word speculative fiction, and I let people go further. Like I said, Ringshot, if you had asked me, I was writing a fantasy story, but it's been classified as horror, as Southern Gothic horror. And I was like, okay, cool. Whatever you guys like. Slipstream, that sounds good to me. But, you know, I said, Ringshot, she has a sword, there are monsters, and she's a heroine who fights them. Sounds like fantasy to me, but I like all of those. And so all this to say, when I'm writing, I tend to think less about the genre than what I need to tell the story. If I have to bring aliens into the story and a spaceship works in the middle of what would be considered fantasy, I'll do it if it works. Right. And that's how I tell people. I understand there are these pockets. A lot of it's important for marketing. This is a business and they definitely need stuff to go. They'll let you know, okay, that's nice that you said all those fancy words, but is it going in the fantasy section or is it going in the sci-fi section? Right. And so a lot of that is marketing and there's the understanding of that. But as far as when I write, I do try to not think fully. I try not to get bogged down in that, because if I have a science world and I want to bring magic into it, and if that's what makes the story work, that's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. So how do you feel about, I feel like Afrofuturism, though, has so much, there's weight behind it.
Yeah.
In like this marketing or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
It's got this real progressive intent built within it.
Yeah.
Do you ever think about that as a genre that is very specific and you cannot really get in there unless you are adhering to it or not?
I think Afrofuturism, like I said, Afrofuturism was a word I liked until it got cool, right? And somebody said, and it was a word that described certain thing. I would think of Sun Ra. I thought of Janelle Monáe when I first saw some of her first albums. I was like, oh, that's Afrofuturism. And I thought of certain people I was reading. I was like, oh, that's an Afrofuturist work. I thought of, like, you know, W.B. Du Bois writing us, like, The Comet, right? Like, way back in the early 1900s. I thought, oh, that's Afrofuturist. But then people would, I would say stuff, I joked once on Twitter, right, where I would say stuff like, I'm going to write a story set in a world where everyone rides dinosaurs, and it's a pre-industrial world, it's a very agrarian world, and everybody's dinosaurs, and those, and all people will nod and I'll say, oh, and they're all black people, and then they'll be like, oh, Afrofuturism. I'd be like, oh, that's not how that works. Right? That's what is futurist about that at all? There's Afro in there, but I don't know where the futurist part comes. And so I have questioned if the word itself has become too much of a catch-all because people know it. And so I've been told this before, like somebody will say, oh, you wrote this and remind me of Octavia Butler. And I was like, what part of my story? Explain to me what part reminds you of Octavia Butler, because I can't find it. Right. And I realize that people are just trying to categorize. They know this is a black author and they're looking for those connections, as human beings do. They look for these connections, and that connective tissue might just not be there. And so, like, people have asked me, is my work Afrofuturist? And I said, I don't know. There are stories that I have written that are near future, and I definitely say so. But like somebody called my last, the one I have, the Dead Cattails Assassin. I said, that's a secondary world where literally it's John Wick meets Dungeons and Dragons. That's how I pitched it. It is a secondary, fully magic fantasy world with a little bit of clockwork. That's about as big as technology gets. There's clockwork automatons there. But other than that, I would not consider it Afrofuturist. But people have extended that word, right, to mean a lot of things now. And so people who write, for instance, are people who write strict fantasy, right? And they write Afro fantasy, and they've asked, like, is Charles Saunders, for instance, the father of Afro fantasy, the modern father of Afro fantasy, like, people call him, like, the black token. I don't like those kind of things. But is his work Afrofuturist? Because there's nothing futurist about it. It's very retro, right? And so there have been people I know black writers and creators who've pushed back and basically said, my work is not Afrofuturist. But then other people have said, perhaps it should just be an umbrella term. But the question is, if the futurist part isn't there. So anyway, all this to say, there are some people, like, for instance, I've thought The Black God's Drums. It's set in 1880s alternate New Orleans, but there's steampunk technology, and it's steampunk technology that does not exist in our world, right? It cannot exist. It's almost fantasy. And so I know one writer, Niecy Shaw, she said perhaps works like that can be considered retrofuturist. And so she said, perhaps this is Afro-retrofuturism, right? And so all this to say, there are a lot of different ways that we can expand the word. But I do wonder if the word fits for certain things. It fits Black Panther, I could see. I think you could even call Jordan Peele's, like, Us, and especially Nope. Those fit those kinds of things in certain writings. But I don't think it fits everything. And so when I do Afrofuturism, I tell people, I'll let you know. I think this was Afrofuturist, but other things, yeah, I don't, the term just doesn't fit, yeah.
I like your response overall, but also the when it got cool part. I mean, but it's an important genre to have been developed.
It is.
It doesn't mean.
And it speaks to so many, I think Afrofuturism really works a lot of modern political issues where there are a lot of people future-looking. There are a lot of people who are in the grade, who are following the grain of like someone like Octavia Butler, whose work is definitively Afrofuturist, right? And or even, I guess you can consider Samuel Delaney, you know, some of his works are that way. And so there's definitely a genre there. And that's, I think, where a lot of Black speculative fiction has been. I even argue that I think a lot of it was that way because there's a whole thing about, you know, the industry. The industry says, like, oh, this like Black Panther was big, so I want more things like that. Whereas, but what about the people doing fantasy or they're doing horror, Black horror? You know, they're doing, like, I know a writer, she does Black horror, like, in, you know, 19th century Gothic. There's not a futurist world there for her, right? So how do you categorize that? And so for me, I use Black speculative fiction, or I'll say Black speculative fiction as a umbrella term, though everyone doesn't like that either. But this is what geeks argue about.
Totally. I mean, I almost love this idea of it being a historical description of the Du Bois comet, of Sun Ra, of Octavia Butler. They didn't get fashioned by the market to continue doing their work. We can just say after the fact that, like, this is the spectrum in which these authors imagined a future of possibility for Black people that is boundless in a way.
Yeah.
And
then some people have decided, I want to imagine a past, right? Or I want to just talk about a now, and I want to talk about something else. And yeah, it's just, I think that Afrofuturism is still an important term, I think, especially for what you're talking about, the politics of it. There have been great works on it, but there's more out there in the Black creative spaces than that. And I think that has to be acknowledged.
Right. So we're getting closer to time. There's a couple of wrap-up questions that I have. Do you have any just other general comments you wanted to make about historical overlaps with genre fiction or anything that you're kind of thinking about right now in terms of how the academia and the fictional aspects can complement? Or
I mean, you know, like I said, I think it's always there. And I think what I always ask people to do is to investigate, like, what historical moment do you think influenced you here? Some historical moment, obviously, or what do you think you were thinking of? You know, it doesn't have to be overt. It doesn't have to be that you're hitting people over the head. And sometimes you want to hit people over the head. Sometimes I don't want you to miss what I'm trying to say, right? I think Ring Shout is definitely, I'm not trying to be subtle. I'm being very, very clear about what I'm doing. And I always ask people to think about those and think about those moments or be aware of what they're writing, right? And people are always concerned about whether they'll get it right or wrong. And I would say, like, you know, just be aware of what you're writing. Be aware of the history if you're writing in other cultures, other places. Be aware of the longer histories there. Be aware of the issues there. That stops you from, you know, doing things that make you later go and cry on Twitter. Don't cry on Twitter.
As far as a Benny song goes, how did you have to, I guess, prepare to write from a young girl's perspective and in the writing have it be applicable to young girls,
young people, period, right? Yeah, I always say that. Like, I mean, somebody, when I wrote the Black God's Drums, they were like, well, it's an own voices, right, type thing. I said, I've never been a 13-year-old Black girl in in New Orleans, so no, it's not, right? So I said, I don't think I've written any stories that are just me, right? They're always somebody else who I cannot possibly be of the age or the time or what have you. And so really, a lot of that was going back and thinking of younger me. I'm not around. Unfortunately, my daughters are 6 years old, so I didn't have them to play. I know people who are, they're like, they're teachers, and they're like, oh, I can tell you all about them. And so I did know some teachers who helped me out with that. But really, a lot of it was thinking back about me at that age and how I was thinking. And so I tried to get into that. And I try to do that when I'm writing the characters. Try to figure out how they would exist in these spaces and how they might operate. And then, you know, editors are great. Editors who know middle grade. And so I would have editors say, like, you did a good thing here, but I need a beat more here because this is what someone this age is really focused on, reminding me of those things. And so, yeah, a lot of that was just getting into that mindset and hoping I get it right, right? Hoping that it feels authentic to what someone that age might feel. And really trying to get into their heads, yeah.
How does someone with a PhD change the words that are in a book for a young adult without, of course, being told that you can't use the word superfluous or something like
right.
this? You
know? You know, that's a good one. That was probably one of the things that I won't say it was difficult, but I had to constantly keep in mind. And sometimes I would write and I would go back and erase it and write it differently. I'd say, I have to remember, I'm writing middle grade. But also I thought, you know, when I was younger, the books that I loved were the ones that were, they may have been middle grade, but they felt like I was reading a book that was for grown-ups, for adults, right? So when I read, you know, Madeline L'Engle's Wrinkle in Time or Wind in the Door, I felt like these books, I feel like I'm reading something different. Like, this isn't, it's marketed towards me. The people are my age, but it just feels different. And I tried to capture that with a Benny song, where it was a book that, yes, it's written for middle graders, but it's not talking down to them either, right? Because nobody wants to be talked down to. And so it was trying to keep that middle bridge where I was like, yeah, the book is going to be challenging. Because when I was that age, I wanted to be challenged. I wanted to be spoken to as if I was more grown, right, than I was. And so I kept that going, as well as with the themes, right? I think middle grade today, along with YA, pushes themes that probably we, as when I was younger, would not have done. And so I was able to push certain themes. And there are certainly some, I don't know, adult themes in there, right? Some serious issues about colonialism, slavery, of other things. I don't want to give away because you haven't read the whole thing yet. But yeah, there's some serious themes in there. And part of my intention was, I want this to be a book that both adults and younger people could read and be like, oh, I like this. And I'd managed to do that with The Black God's Drums, not trying. I wrote The Black God's Drums thinking of, you know, again, in my head, I'm not thinking I'm writing for adults, I'm writing for kids, I'm just writing a book. And back then, I wasn't really thinking of marketing. Now, unfortunately, it's there in my head. I just wrote it, and when it was published, it turned out that a lot of people were buying it for their middle grade kids. No, pardon me, they were buying it because they saw a young person on the cover and giving it to their kids, and then they were reading it too. And so much so that the American Library Association actually gave it an award, an Alex Award. It's a crossover book, and they give awards to these books that are written, and they're not marketed as YA or middle grade children's books, but they cross over. And so that was unintentional. With a Benny song, I tried to replicate that in many ways, yeah.
I had no idea that award existed. That's a great way of thinking about, yeah, who's the person buying and then who is receiving to read. That makes me think about when I first tried to read Gormenghast and at like the age of 12 or something, and it's like, this is insane. Let's try The Lord of the Rings, and that even really was too much. But
But you need to think of The Hobbit, and it's like, it's much more of a simpler story, right? It's your gateway.
Yes. Yeah. Totally. Gateway for the early
fiction.
And
you read your Dragonlance by the time you get to middle and high school, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you so much for being on the show. I just want to give you the opportunity to do one last plug about anything that you're currently working on that you maybe want to share.
Oh, what am I working on now? I'm working on a Benny song, book two, Benny and the Kingdom of Gold. It's and what's great is you get to like the characters age up a bit, and you figure the readers have aged up. So as you were saying, I can get a bit more complicated in the story. And so it's a trilogy. So book two, I'm in copy edits for, and book three, I have to start writing. So there's that.
Do you have deadlines? Do people put deadlines on you?
That's one of the great, everybody was like, what's it like being in the writing world? I said, it's a job.
No.
It's a job with deadlines. Yeah. No. I realize I got another job. I got a second writing job. I said, and I mean, you feel like a jerk for complaining because there's so many people who are, you're trying to get in here. But just know that when you do, people will give you an advance and stuff if you're lucky. And then they will demand that, look, I gave you money. I expect these books and I need these deadlines. And so that means that I don't get to sit down and watch Netflix and watch, oh, what's the latest thing on Netflix? Everybody's watching. I don't get to do that. I get to go home and over the weekend and at night, copy edit several hundred pages. What a fine thing, because there are deadlines. Then I have the next thing that's due that I need to immediately start on. So anyway, all the would-be writers out there, this is not to scare you away. Just be aware that it's going to be a job when you get it. It's work. It's fun, but it's still work.
Labor of love. You heard it right here from Assistant Professor Dexter Gabriel of the UConn History Department, also writing speculative fiction under the pen name P. Jelly Clark. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being on this episode of Darshiv. You've really helped us unpack more about what goes into writing and how can history inform us. And hopefully the archives can be of service to that. So thanks for being on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We will catch everybody next time. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. For more information on the Archives and Special Collections, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and the web. Our theme song is Dream in Casio Tone by Arable Lands. Graphic design by Melika Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.